Mini episode 581 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by First Down Scouting, delivering the most thorough scouting service available, uncovering the NFL stars of tomorrow. Follow them on the web at the number one, stdownscouting.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross. This is the Kyle Ross History of the Royal Rumble Anthology. If you want to hear how the Royal Rumble came to be, the setup, the background, go to Part 1A, 1988. We are now in Part 3, 1996 to 1999, and I feel like I need to explain this because if you've been listening to 93 to 95, we refer to that as part of a series that goes through 97. Kyle is changing it up midstream here. Again,
it wouldn't be a Kyle Ross anthology without changing things midstream, but for good reason.
For very good reason, and again, to further break kayfabe, we are recording the 96 one along with the subsequent ones today in the third era of the Royal Rumble. We did the ones previously, 93 to 95, all in one sitting earlier. And again, subsequently, Kyle, it made sense to go in this direction because, as you indicated, these are the wartime Royal Rumbles.
Yes, and I'm not talking about, 1991 and that ill taste for Mr. McMahon and company. No, and it really, us kind of changing the parts has nothing to do with our recording time at all. It just so happened, I remember, so we finished 95. It was getting late, and we were kind of tired. I was like, Ricky, I'm tired. I want to do these. We're all good. I want to keep them going. Let's table it. We'll get back.
Okay.
So then I started doing the notes, and you and I had talked, even before I left, how if we wanted to consider 93 to 97 to one part, and then we were going to go and do 98 to 2002, which is generally considered the attitude era of the company, more or less, as a separate part. Those two eras, sort of, if you think of them as a Venn diagram, 96 to 99 is the shaded area. Because those are the years where we are in the midst of the Monday Night War. Now, I know technically the Monday Night War lasted until 2001, but WCW by 2000 was a corpse. And the war was all but over. I mean, if you looked, WWF in 2000 versus WCW in 2000, that's not a contest.
Right.
There was no contest. I mean, by that point, 2000, they didn't care about WCW.
Right.
But they certainly did in 96.
Yep.
So we've gone part one, just to recap, the beginning to the best. That was a fairly creative name, I thought. That was 88, which was the very first televised Rumble, to 92, which I consider on a pedestal of its own, certainly the best. It's in its own tier. The much more uncreatively named, the down years, encompass 93 to 95.
Yes.
And I think, there was, as you watched it, and certainly you were really hammering on it.
Hated.
Yeah. You
especially 94, 95.
Yeah, and I agree with you on 95. I thought 94 was better than you gave it credit for.
I thought 93 was better than you gave it credit for.
Which was fun. So
yeah,
we had that. And now we go in to part three, the Monday Night War era. Now that everyone's confused and we just keep saying eras and talking about our own personal schedule.
So this is 3A, 1996.
Okay. So the big thing here that we need to talk about and go back is September 95, WCW kicks off Nitro. And it's pretty even, really, for the first, 6 months. It's the first 6 to 8 months or so. I mean, really, until the NWO comes
neck
about in
neck.
The summer.
Yeah.
The second half of 96 is truly, no matter what the ratings may say, I thought the second half of 1996 was when, at least creatively, WCW was furthest ahead of WWF as it ever was.
To that point, anyways, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the second half, but in the first half of 96, things are pretty even. And there's actually no WCW pay-per-view in January 96.
Right.
When WWF holds the Royal Rumble, as is tradition. And with the war starting, the Monday Night War starting, there's definitely, and this is why we're kind of shifting parts here. there's definitely a change from 95. Yes, there's a lot of the same characters, even on top. But we begin to see, and you remarked about this, and I kind of went back and noticed it as well, about the elements of attitude, the first elements of attitude.
Yep.
The show opens with this parental discretion is advised thing with Sonny in the bathtub.
Yep.
You also have Gold Dust, which we will get into
in
a little bit. That would not fly today, by the way.
The Razor Ramon homophobia storyline.
Yes, yes. The Billionaire Ted skits, which was a direct way of firing back at WCW. Funny in parts, ineffective in others. The direction of the Diesel character, where he basically was just Kevin Nash, called Diesel. I mean, you know, he was kind of cutting these quasi-shoot promos. He flipped, you know, he was flipping off The Undertaker.
You know what's funny? It feels like you've seen my notes already, although I know you haven't, because in the post game show that they did for the thing,
which needs to be mentioned.
Yeah,
that was a bizarre thing.
I think they,
how scientific am I be with that?
They wanted to hype the February pay per view. They wanted to get you in the mode of we have a pay per view between now and WrestleMania because it was all about getting ready for the next month. I'll tell you what, Diesel. In that interview, I was struck. I mean, proto Kevin Nash right before our eyes. That was NWO Kevin Nash coming through in that moment. So it's so weird. I'm used to not thinking of that uber snide, sarcastic persona until he sets foot in WCW. He was bringing it there in the post show.
He was much better after losing the championship.
Yes.
His character. You know,
yes.
I mean, we always joke about Smiling Diesel, and he even joked about it, I believe, in his promos right after.
Yep.
He was, you know, better is a relative term. I enjoyed him more.
Right.
In that small window as post champion, kind of when he went.
Sure.
When he was a quasi heel and then went full on heel at the end. It should also be pointed out, Monday Night War. You know, obviously the first huge win for WCW, well, besides getting Nitro up and running and as a viable entity, was signing away Diesel and Razor.
Yes.
Nash and
Hall. Subsequently.
What struck me here, and I want to hear get your response on this,
is
that when you watch the show, you have Razor Ramon, he loses the Intercontinental title to Goldust here.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned Goldust earlier. Which
Marlena made her debut, by the way.
And it was predictable, I think, and it was probably the right decision. But Hall seems somewhat expendable. Like, losing him, it was big. Make no mistake. He was one of their big guys, but it didn't seem like he was irreplaceable. Nash, on the other hand, so much of this show was built around him. Like, that was, to me, losing him was huge when you see how much he was featured in promos. Not only for this, but building to the next show where he winds up challenging Bret. And by the way, another key point we need to make here in talking about the 96 Rumble is the first time we have a February pay-per-view between the Rumble and Mania. Up to this point, we had not had that. They basically, up until 95, they sort of set the Mania main event at the Rumble, and you had it.
In the early days, you would have the main event in February on NBC. The very early days, there would be... That
yeah, like
the 89, same purpose.
Like 89,
yes.
You're right,
yes.
you're right.
And even, exactly.
And, you know, but even then, like even in 90, you sort of, you know, everyone wanted to see Hogan Warrior coming off that Rumble. Even if the world champion was in that one. It was
a little
different. But anyway, you know what I'm saying? Like, this show was, a large part of it was built around Diesel. And it to me, I'm watching like, wow, that had to kill Vince losing him.
It's
very clear that Razor was on the way down. Fourth year in a row, by the way, in an Intercontinental title match. Or, pardon me, third year in a row.
You could win this trivia contest in a bar. He was never in a Royal Rumble match. I found that very interesting. His span there, he was never in a Royal Rumble match.
Wow.
WWF title, and then the three ICs, and then he's gone.
It's interesting, but you know what? It kind of felt like he was in a holding pattern. It's like, all right, in 94, going back, he wins, he beats IRS. 95, you know, you and I talked about it was a mistake having him lose to Jarrett. And then 96, he loses to Goldust, which you could see coming. And it was kind of like two losses in a row. Okay, he's a four-time Intercontinental champion. Unless if they're going to shoot him to the top.
Here's the thing, though. They never did. And when I talk about those couple months being an era of culmination, I think about this also that, boy, if they'd ever put Razor in that mix, they were so thin on top in their worst years. And Razor was credible at that level. Razor won the IC title feud with Diesel in 94. Diesel becomes champ a few months later, and Razor is never in the WWF title picture.
It was weird. You know, I think losing to Jarrett, going back to the previous year, hurt him. That was dumb. Gold, probably did. But the Gold Dust thing you could see coming because the way they were, how strong they were pushing Gold Dust.
Right.
Jarrett would seem like a bad idea all around. And it kind of hurt Razor because he never beat him back. And he kind of just stayed in limbo for a lot of 95. But anyway, so we've got these first vestiges of the Attitude Era, right?
Poking through, yep.
We have not even referenced, the two main pieces of this show, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, who would go on, of course, to wrestle in the Iron Man match at WrestleMania. And we will shortly, because I think there are issues with both in this. I just wanted to say this. It's like, okay, you can see the influence here, but this is not a good show overall.
I would agree. I don't think it was a very good show. You talk about we've talked about foreshadowing in a couple different areas here, foreshadowing the Attitude Era with some of the things, foreshadowing the Kevin Nash persona in WCW subsequently. One more thing, too, and I know you said this was a part that you may have fast-forwarded through. When Sonny came out for the Body Donna's Guns tag team title match, which was mediocre at best, she's giving a spiel.
The tag division was not good in 1986.
Oh, God, it was continuing on from what it had been the previous 3 years. Really, ever since the Steiners were out of the title picture, it was nothing to write home about. And that was 2.5 years by this point. As she's giving her spiel, and it just caught my ear. It made me sit up straight in my chair. She references as she's going into her fancy introduction, children of all ages. And I'm going, ooh, I know somebody in the back who liked the sound of that, grabbed a pencil and wrote it down. You think old Brian James was paying attention there that night?
I mean, she didn't. People say that all the time, don't they?
That would only go on to become maybe the most famous crowd interaction back and forth of the Attitude Era, that line there.
Yeah, I think you're working a little too hard. Pat Patterson used that in 98, by the way.
Pat Patterson?
Yes. Well, in the tremendous Over the Edge spiel.
Okay, so he was directly parodying, though, the Road Dogg.
No, I think he thought he was funny, I think. I think you're trying a little hard with that one, Ricky. I'm not going to give you credit. I mean, maybe you heard something. Okay, fine.
You don't think that was the equivalent of Pat Tanaka coming out to Goldberg's music 6 months beforehand? That was what it made me think of.
Forgot about that.
Well, there were some other just undercard things here as well. They had an opening promo on the show, as they sometimes did with this. It set up the title match in the Rumble. A couple of the title matches. Vince and Mr. Perfect were the announcers.
They did not do a good job.
Perfect was barely more tolerable than DiBiase in 94, and that's a low bar. He was awful. God rest his soul.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that. He was better here than he was when he first debuted.
Right.
The problem with both Perfect and DiBiase is it seemed like they really weren't following things that well.
Right.
Perfect was better here. I mean, when he kind of came in cold at Survivor Series the previous year, he would just, remember me, I was perfect. Just like DiBiase was like, you remember me, I just used to buy everything. And it's like, dude, stop getting yourself over.
Exactly. Like, they couldn't stop, promoting their own gimmick. That was what made it really
bad. Vince can be good in a different way, not in a Jim Ross sense.
Right.
But he can, look, he's the one. He's the one signing off on all the storylines, so he knows what he wants to get over.
He's like Gorilla was. He could be carried to a certain point if he had the
he's
right.
He's better than Gorilla, I think.
Oh, I liked Gorilla better, probably, as an announcer.
Oh, no.
I would take Gorilla and Heenan over Vince and Heenan or Vince and Ventura, but that's just me.
I'll say this. If you took Ventura or Heenan away from Gorilla, oh, boy.
Oh, no, I understand
but, yeah,
that.
But I'm just saying, Vince seemed distracted. I don't know if it was WCW or what here. He just seemed off his game.
Yeah, he wasn't very good.
Particularly in the Rumble, which we'll get to.
Well, a lot of the booking stuff, too, wasn't very good. Like, for example, the free-for-all. This is one of the times that they did a thing of jerking with the numbers. Number one versus number 30.
I didn't mind this, despite the participation of Duke the Dumpster Drosy.
Yeah, he won by DQ. He got number 30.
Yeah,
Triple H got number one. Well, In a way, it made sense because Triple H, even then, was a guy they saw something in. Number one, he's going to be in there a long time. It's a showcase spot. So putting him in early made sense.
Yeah, I understand why. By the way, this is not a bad idea to do. I'm surprised. They've never really done that since. They've never stolen this idea of having a match where the winner, you know, just between two random guys.
Right.
It kind of helps these two guys get over a little bit more, because let's be honest, even, you know, these guys' families didn't think that they were going to win the Rumble, but it sort of is like, oh, remember Triple H, he lost the match, now he's number one.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, Duke Drossi, dear God.
I know.
But it's like, hey, he had to win something to get 30, and it kind of puts over number 30.
Well,
I think it's, they should do this more often as the opening match on a Rumble pay-per-view.
That would be interesting
with
if
better
they
people.
Did that. Yeah, yeah, obviously, yeah, with guys higher up on the card
Triple
than they
H
were then.
Should be pointed out here, and we'll be talking, obviously, about him for many years to come.
Yes.
As we go through these Rumbles. He would still have a lot to improve. He improved. Needless to say, he improved a lot after 1996.
He did. He also
he just
had
nice hair and a silly gimmick.
He also had better opportunities, but that's another story for another day.
Yeah.
Other things.
There we go.
Other things from there. Jeff Jarrett and Ahmed Johnson in the opener.
This is one of the worst opening matches of any pay-per-view I've ever
totally
seen.
Totally agree. Totes agree. DQ finish, which was horrible. Jarrett just should have been fed to Ahmed at that point, because Ahmed was kind of on a roll at this point. 96 was a good year for him till the kidney injury. Just feed Jarrett to him.
Oh, wait. I just wanted to say this.
Yeah.
During this period of time, this was another kind of demark different from, like, the last couple years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when they started doing these, but they always, like, in 96 and 97... they had the best opens for these pay-per-views. Like, they would have, like, these opening, like, it was, I don't know who narrated them, but it was, they had the same
the video
narrator.
Packages, yeah.
To open it, like, they had, like, this thing, like, and it would get over the storylines coming
yeah.
in. And it would have, like, these macro ideas.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They were always really good in these 2 years.
Right.
But, yeah, as for the, I'll tell you what, from the video package to this opening, I don't know who booked this dog. It was the second show in a row where they just should have not booked the match. They should have put Ahmed with someone else. If you remember in the December pay-per-view, he was originally supposed to work with Dean Douglas, who was on his way out.
Uh-huh.
And Jarrett was on his way out here,
and
too.
And it ended up being Buddy Landell, right?
Yeah, because I think Dean was like, I'm not jobbing. And
past
like,
lounge guest Buddy Landell. A very underrated talent.
So here's the thing. Ahmed needed guys fed to him. And Ahmed did have, you know, look, Ahmed got lazy.
Right.
And didn't pan out. But
he needed to feed
He seemed like
him.
A star. I remember being pretty into Ahmed Johnson actually this time.
Yes.
And he needed a guy he needed to beat. So you have a match here where you're putting Ahmed with a guy who has no interest in putting him over.
Right.
And, like, this just serves no one. It just all seemed to build to that guitar spot off the top rope.
Right.
Which, again, you kind of see the early vestiges of things you'd see in years to come, the Attitude Era with some of the hardcore stuff. But it just didn't work. It just seemed like a colossal waste of time. Jarrett had no interest in making Ahmed look good.
Right.
And it was just pretty horrible.
Well, look.
Ahmed Johnson did do a plancha.
That in and of itself was something to write home about. I want to, in case there's anybody out there, and I can't imagine there would be, if there's anybody out there that wants to challenge me on this point of how Jarrett should have just been fed to him, I'm going to cut that off right at the pass, and here's why. Because, yes, Jarrett did have a good record in the Intercontinental title scene. Not that he was a good champion, but, I mean, on paper, kayfabe-wise, he had a pretty good – kayfabe-wise, Kyle Ross, he had a good track record. He was a couple-time Intercontinental champion. He had an established record. As a worker, as a wrestler, you and I have our own opinions. But kayfabe-wise, you can't argue with me. He was one of the more successful guys, 94 and 95, in the company. He just was. There's no disputing that. Couple-time Intercontinental champion. End of story. But here's the thing. He wasn't as accomplished as Goldust, and Goldust got fed to him clean a couple months later for the Intercontinental title. Nobody out there can argue with me, and I'm probably arguing with the world's biggest straw man, because I don't know that anybody's going to stick up for Jeff Jarrett in this regard. But
no,
Jeff Jarrett should have been fed.
Especially on his way out of the promotion.
Should have been fed clean. Well, even if he was sticking around, Goldust was sticking around, he was still fed clean to Ahmed, and it made sense. It was the right move. We have covered, I think, the entire non-Rumble card, aside from the title match. Yeah. Do we want to do that after it because of the things that happen sequentially? Do we want to do the Rumble match, then the title match?
Yeah. Well, actually, hold on. Let's just hit a couple things here.
Yeah.
You talk about there was the tag title match, the Body Downs, the Smoking Guns. I just
sucked.
Think, the tag title division. And it was, I guess, I see your point. You know, when I said, in 96, the tag division sucked, it had been a larger problem for a while. Because, in 95, they were kind of just throwing people together, you know, because you had Owen and Yoko. But they actually, like, tried to establish a division here. And it was basically, the whole thing was just a vehicle to keep Sonny over. Which,
again.
Sonny was, that's okay, but the team, like, the matches were always so bad. It was always some form of Body Donnas, Godwins, Smoking Guns.
Right.
And it always sucked.
And again, the Body Donnas, minus the gimmick, really good. Candido and Pritchard, really good.
Yeah, but that was a horrible gimmick.
It was a horrible gimmick that brought them down. And they were working with bad workers a lot of times on the other side,
I'm surprised they didn't go over here.
I kind of am, too. I really kind of am.
It seemed that they were already, they eventually do get the titles.
Right.
But, I was kind of shocked they didn't go over, because the Smoking Guns, they weren't going anywhere.
No, they weren't. I share your kind of disdain for that whole tag team.
Razor Gold
there.
Dust. I didn't want to, we really didn't talk about the match. We kind of talked about Razor.
Like, how much is there to say? Because I didn't think much of the match, really. I mean,
the Marlene, I guess, we alluded there. To it. We were, I think, so fired up.
It was
who is
this woman? You know, like, they didn't even give her a name yet.
Did you catch at the time it was Terry Runnels? Like, right when it happened? Like, Alexandra York?
I think so,
I remember catching on. I thought it was, like, so smart. Like, and again, I thought it was so smart that I knew that Goldust was Dustin
Rhodes.
Where's
her laptop? I don't see it.
Yes. Just a couple notes on this.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think we were just came out of the gates firing. And let's get orderly here, Rick Morris.
All right.
Let's pump the brakes.
Slow this match down a little. Settle into a chin lock.
Yes. I said it earlier. The gay overtones would not fly today. Oh, you can't do that.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of like McMahon was kind of trying to downplay it, too. You could tell that he's like, okay. And Mr. Perfect, again, you know, last guy watching TV, apparently.
Right.
He kept, like, making jokes, and McMahon kept, like, no-selling all of them.
Right.
That's
amusing
to listen to.
Which went beyond the whole face and heel announcer shtick. It went way beyond that.
Yeah. And the debut of Marlena was to counteract the whole gayness of the Goldust character. It's like, oh, look, he's got a woman. He can't be
Although
he's not trying to, you know, queer the world anymore.
I'm going to tease for 97. I have a comment about what they did booking him for 97.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah. Marlena played a key role in his turn the next year in ways that I find very interesting. But, yeah, this match to me, again, you know, I didn't talk much about it because, again, I, you know, didn't find it compelling.
Do you agree with the title? It was time to put the... Do you agree with the decision to put the title on Goldust?
Yeah, I mean, if you buy into the whole thing of this gimmick is going to get this push, if you're going to resign yourself to that, then absolutely. I have problems with, again, putting the title on a gimmick like this that doesn't have, to me, whoever wears the Intercontinental.
Probably didn't need the gimmick because the gimmick itself can kind of be over.
And I think that's my thing. Leave it in the circus. Leave it in the circus acts division because to me,
he didn't even defend it at WrestleMania, and he loses to Roddy Piper.
Yeah, I'm kind of a purist. Like whoever holds the IC,
that's become obvious.
Well, yeah, whoever holds the IC title should be a viable WWF champion. WWF at the time, of course. Goldust was never going to be in the world title picture.
Yeah.
So don't put the IC on him.
I think, though, well, again, you know, Jarrett, the same could be said about here. I had less of a problem with this than Jarrett the previous year.
I agree, because Jarrett's gimmick was...
Jarrett was never over. I'll say, this needs to be said, though, when I watched this. Do you know what struck me?
What?
When I was trying not to laugh at Perfect making Vince McMahon uncomfortable.
What?
Scott Hall could be a great worker when he wanted to. And boy, did that end when he went.
So
to
could Dustin Rhodes, but these guys were horrible together
but
in this setting.
To me, it was so shocking to see how bad he got in WCW and how lazy and unmotivated.
This
he got.
Was the beginning of that. Yeah,
yeah. Like after this was sort of the last appearance of a trying Scott Hall in the ring.
Right.
So that's that. So.
Well, you know, how fitting was that? Because a couple months earlier, I think we had seen the demise of Make a Difference Fatu, and now this was the demise of Give a Crap Razor Ramon.
Oh, there we go. You with this Making a Difference Fatu. Tell me about that. All right. Let's talk about the Rumble.
Shall we?
I think we should talk about the Rumble first because, to a point, didn't go on last. I thought this, although this is not the worst Rumble of all time, it's not. The 95 is, the previous year.
I say 2 stars. I got it on the lower ebb.
Oh, wow. You actually have it lower than me. I had it 2.25, so we're starting to agree here.
Yeah, but you have, like, star inflation, though. Like almost all of yours are rated above mine because you rate almost all Rumbles above where I've got them. Two stars for me is medium to regular low.
It's funny you mention that. I think I have 16 of them rated between 2 and 3.25 stars.
Okay.
Pretty mediocre to me.
Okay.
Not a lot of those are still the cut. We'll talk about, you know, we've got a lot to talk about, but... Yeah, I got this at 2.25, and I think this is kind of the low point for the Rumble. Like, you know, it's interesting that early on, when we very first started, back in that Part 1A that you referenced, we talked about how this, what do we know about the Rumble, that it wound up becoming the second most important pay-per-view of the year. At this point, even with the build to WrestleMania... I still think it was behind SummerSlam, and the Rumble match itself, not going on last, I think you could make a case that this was the real low point for the Rumble match. It had to do a little bit with company depth, because it was still low here.
Yeah.
Not going on last, I think, you know, I could be, you know, Kyle Kayfabe here, but I think that's telling. The Rumble, to me, the Rumble should... always go on.
But it did what it was supposed to do as far as getting over the contender for WrestleMania. The right guy went over, to use your criteria.
Yeah.
It established him as a big deal coming off of the kayfabe injury. So, I mean, yes and no, I think, with what you're saying.
They did it, and there are some reasons we'll see in the future why the Rumble doesn't go on last because of, you know, some angles they're booking or whatever. And in this case, they wanted to have the Diesel and Undertaker face-off that led to Diesel coming back and interfering in Bret Undertaker.
Yep.
So in that regard, I'm just saying that, to me, the Rumble should be last. Look, there can always be exceptions to the rule.
You don't think it ends with what they want to leave you with at the end of the show? Because I'm not as dogmatic about that. I think it's all about... what you want that lasting image to be in everyone's mind at the end of the show. To me, sometimes it's the Rumble. To me, sometimes it's the title match.
Okay. I am not a strict constructionalist by any means.
And on this, I'm a good liberal. I have very situational ethics on this.
Okay, I mean, look, there are some times when I do. It was just something that I noticed. I was like, whoa, this is the first time the Rumble's not closing.
Okay.
And you're right. There are some extenuating circumstances why.
Right.
But in the same regard, I don't know. It just kind of made it seem maybe not as good. But it's for the Rumble itself. Let's get into the meat and potatoes of this, if you will.
Okay.
I thought this got off to a terrible start. There was, like, no eliminations early. Like, guys just kept coming out and not being eliminated. And it was, to me, there always kind of needs to be, you kind of need to book. There needs to be, you know, never, I don't like when there's more than 8 guys in there usually.
Right.
But, like, here, it was just, they just kept, guy would come out, not be eliminated. Nothing was really happening.
Well, and I'd like to throw this out there as well. Something that would be a fun thing, if there's anybody out there that has the notion of maybe having, like, a Royal Rumble marathon party and just watching a bunch of old Rumbles, one thing that you could do if you wanted to make a drinking game, things they said or did they couldn't do today. We already referenced one of those in terms of Goldust and the homosexual angle there. Another one, entrance music for Barry Horowitz. Did you catch what it was?
No.
Hava Nagila. It was. I am not lying. One more thing you couldn't do
today. By
the
way, Barry Horowitz being in the Rumble, I wish that there weren't worse people, but there were. I mean, the star power in this thing was bad.
He was, in fairness, he was in the middle of that inexplicable underdog push,
which was perfectly acceptable wrestling.
Right.
I didn't mind that. He actually did get a little over for a little bit.
But kayfabe
Chris
wise,
Candido. But
it
you
was
know what?
Awful.
The fact that there were people less over and like less viable in this thing than Barry Horowitz is sad. Doug Gilbert.
Yes.
Sorry. The Headhunters. or yeah. whatever they
the,
were called.
The squat
something.
Team.
they, yeah, the squat.
They,
yeah,
they
yeah,
were
the squat.
Squat, let me tell
and,
you.
And I know you're going to get really upset about this. Dory Funk Jr. had no business in this thing.
Well, Dory Funk Jr. kayfabe-wise, we're talking about a former
if
world
if this was
champion.
The 1976 Royal Rumble, it would have been great.
Well, I'll tell you what. I will say, very, very striking. And I mean, Vince must have been...
Again, bringing out someone from the outside world.
That had to be so painful to him because he referred to Dory Funk Jr. as a former NWA champion, probably the first time those initials, I think, were on the TV since they went national. Amore referred to as an All-Japan wrestler.
Oh, I didn't even mention him.
Had to be...
Getting the Orient Express music.
Well, yeah, and... Like, how jarring was that to the fans? Because I always refer to you about all the Mark Markersons in the audience. How many people were watching us going, wait a minute, there's other promotions that exist in the world? That had to be very jarring to the people that were listening,
but
the core audience.
My issue with it is that it was a bunch of guys just coming in for a one-and-done shot.
Right.
And that's bad. You don't want that.
Doug Gilbert, as you mentioned, getting the full-on welcome to the big-time treatment from Vince on commentary.
Yeah, it sounds like very Michael Cole-esque of him, by the way.
Yeah, again, very weird. And this is the one time that I can remember that the initials USWA were on WWF television. Not all those times with Jerry the King Lawler, who was the anchor of the promotion. Very strange in that regard. You've mentioned on previous things that we've done that Kurt Hennig mentioning about how he won some tournament in Memphis to be in there, and Vince was like, well, yeah, I guess so, or some dismissive kind of a
You know what? God bless reply. Hennig. He was like, yeah, you want to – Vince is like, it's like, Vince, what do you mean, I guess so? Like,
yeah.
Why? I guess so. Vince, if you didn't want him to be in it, why did you book
him?
By the way, speaking of things I didn't understand in this match,
yeah,
why was Bob Holly in this thing so long? Like, it's sort of, I thought it took away from Triple H doing the same.
Yeah.
Pardon me, Hunter Hearst Helmsley,
right.
Not yet Triple H.
Right.
That made no sense to me. I mean, you talk about a guy who was going nowhere in 96.
No sense at all. I agree with that.
Should we? A couple things.
Okay.
As I'm just flying all through my notes here. Jake Roberts makes his return here, and he
yes.
was as over as anyone.
Well, and what I have in my notes is... That while the star power was certainly not amazing, it was much better than it was in 94 and 95. You had Shawn Diesel, Bulldog, Yokozuna, guys who had been on or near the top for a few years, Vader, Jake, Backlund, and Waller. This was Vader's first real thing of any note that he did there.
Bob Backlund is not adding star power in 1996.
He was, the second longest reigning world champion in the history of the company, Kyle Ross.
Yeah, and he was a complete jobber at this point.
Well, he didn't mean as much, but
that would be putting it mildly.
But that's some veteran kind of gravitas to this. Him and Jake and Waller and Dory Funk Jr.
Waller, I'll sign off on Roberts, but not Dory Funk or Bob Backlund.
Well,
Roberts was actually a guy who was being used, and you know, obviously, he winds up putting over.
Right.
You know, of course, you know, does one of the most famous jobs of all time is Steve Austin, who, by the way, makes his Royal Rumble debut here
yes.
as the ringmaster.
And
perfect, put him over. Perfect earned some stripes with me putting over Austin. Kept saying, I like this guy.
Yeah.
I feel that he wasn't told to do that. So
I
I'll
caught
give that
as
perfect.
Well. Isaac Yankum DDS making his debut in the match here. Now, do they
another
add,
dog.
Do they add his stats to those of Kane when we're talking about most lifetime eliminations? I'd like to know that.
That's some good points.
Yeah.
Here's something. This is the only Rumble Yokozuna didn't win that he was in.
Oh,
he was only
good point.
In two, but he won the other one.
That's an excellent point. They teased the Yoko and Vader split at various times.
We got to get it together. This has been a shot. This has been very shoddy.
No. Well, we're hitting these things, you know, as we're going through.
We got to talk about Vader.
That.
What a big deal. That was the story of the first half of this
the
Rumble.
The clearing out spot, yes. And what he did in there. And this is the interesting thing that I thought, Kyle. I put this in my notes, that we criticized them as a company. One of their most consistent failures throughout a period of time. The first real outsider thing I can think of is probably Flair in 91. They always botched the outsider thing. Vader, while not really being booked as an outsider... For once, they did
everyone
it in a
knew who Vader was. Everyone knew Vader from WCW.
He was. It was clear that he was signed and he was part of the promotion. But Kyle, That's how you push an outsider. For him to make his first big mark coming in there and going wrecking crew on everybody, that was beautiful.
Yeah, I did. I'll tell you what, I did like the way he was booked. Up until, I didn't like, and we should again, Shawn Michaels is such a story in this thing, we haven't really referenced him.
I figured we would towards the end since he's winning. So.
Yes, okay. I didn't like how he eliminated Vader and Yoko simultaneously, although that did get over really
right.
huge. And nor did I like Vader coming back in and tossing Michaels.
Right.
It would have been okay if he would have just destroyed him.
Right.
But throwing, because that rule has been so liberally ignored, used, guys.
That's
like,
true. Yeah.
I didn't like that. That's just a little.
That's a good point.
That's a rare me being nitpicky and following kayfabe.
Okay. Well, Nelson nitpicker for me.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't like that as much.
Well, here's a weird stat when it comes to Shawn also, too. This is and this shows you – we've talked about this before when we've done segments about the WWF during their down years, of which this was still one of them, even if we're not classifying it as such for our bracketing purposes.
This show
here.
Did – business actually showed some upticks.
Yeah, it here. Did. It did. But here's – given that it was still part of that same general down period and coming off of the horrific 95 – one of the things that they would do, from year to year, Rumble, WrestleMania, whatever, it would almost always be a different plan than what it was the previous year. They kept trying out different guys on top, and a lot of times that meant turning somebody that was a successful heel and having them go face, as they did with Diesel, as they did with Shawn. This is what was interesting. Diesel, in 94, they invented the Diesel push. 95, again, you have a situation where Diesel wins at WrestleMania as a face. Shawn in 95 wins the Royal Rumble as a heel, a pretty successful heel at the time. And in 96, Shawn is going to win at WrestleMania as a face, this time having won the Royal Rumble. Diesel the previous year defended the title at the Royal Rumble. But it was interesting that, again, they were trying a thing with turn a guy and by the next year target him to be at the top of the card. And very interesting as well, too, they teased what would be the turn to come in February, pre-WrestleMania, of Diesel all the way, with Michaels and Diesel there toward the end. A little bit of dissension teased afterwards. The finishing sequence, I thought it was a little bit weird, because it went from three down to Michaels and Diesel to a quick elimination. The end of it seemed a little bit rushed. I don't know if they were behind on time or
it
what
did,
it was.
It did feel rushed, and again,
yeah.
They had another match to come.
Right.
And I'm trying to find the buy rates for this. I have his page looked up. But.
You are right that business, because I remember that at the time, because I think it was from Brett's book, actually. He, of course, noted in there that there was an upturn in business during his time on top, brief though it was, interregnum though it was, leading to Shawn taking it at WrestleMania. And I'm pretty sure I remember Bret Hart making the point that they were in a little bit of a business upturn
and,
at the time.
And the house show started even better with Michaels on top. Michaels
right.
and Bret, it obviously got very ugly
right.
after WrestleMania, and they would start doing things. It was funny that the TV, a lot of it having to do with the fact WCW got hot with the NWO, was kind of low. But the house show business really picked up with Michaels on top. And mm-hmm. by all indications, because it was very clear at this point, we'll get into that when we talk about the booking of Bret momentarily. It was very clear Michaels was going over at WrestleMania,
sure.
unlike the previous year. And let's talk about, Shawn Michaels back-to-back wins here.
Right.
Unlike the previous year where it's like, okay, he's a heel. He's probably not going to go over.
At that point, it was still heels never win at WrestleMania.
Yeah. But here, it was pretty obvious. They had been building for a year.
Right.
To him, kind of almost a year. He turns face the next night on Raw. After losing to Diesel at WrestleMania,
and for
11.
Much of 95,
yeah.
it was a more popular face than Diesel anyways.
Yeah, he really was. It's mm-hmm. actually pretty shocking that how long it got drawn out.
Right.
But he was effective, and he was the right guy to go over.
Yep.
The closing sequence was really rushed. Him and Diesel coming down to the old friends, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the comparable Rumble I have to this one is 91.
Okay.
Where... You pretty much knew who was winning.
Right.
And it was the right decision. But
I think this was better than 91, though. Do you agree? I would take this over 91.
I have them same, 2.25.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why I have it.
All right. because I have 91 as one of my lowest ones, somewhere below 2 stars. I don't remember off the top of my head. This is 2 stars in my book. I have it being decent. So you have at the end there, Diesel has the frustration at the end. He leaves the ring. There's that whole hearkening back to the days, or one of the great tropes, hearkening back to Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik. The sort of passing each other in the aisle way and stare down and get out of my way, you big lug. So him and Undertaker are doing that, having that moment before Taker comes out for the title match. And that, of course, teases what's going to happen in the end. But you have Bret Hart in there with Taker. It was interesting to see Undertaker in the title scene because for the previous couple of years, and I think this is another way that they dropped the ball, in Vince's book, with The Undertaker as a special attraction, you always had a semi-main event. But he had become, to borrow an RVD phrase here, to fit it to this purpose slightly, Mr. Semi-Main Event. And now you finally had him back at the title picture, where he should have been for, I think, a good period of time, albeit it was the setup at WrestleMania. What? You guessed it? A semi-main event with Diesel. But it was very interesting to see him in there and to see Bret and Undertaker working the whole face versus face, big man versus medium-sized man gimmick, the exact same way that you saw the year before with Bret and Diesel. And you had some of the same challenges, I thought, in terms of getting heat in matches like this. And for as much as guys like me, and I think to an extent you, if I remember correctly, will sometimes sit here and be like, what? You don't want to do something just because it's face versus face or heel versus heel? I know that I have been known to rag on promotions for being a little bit too afraid of that. This match, to me, kind of showed why you don't want to do that often. It didn't have a lot of heat. The crowd didn't really have anybody to rally behind, no, I thought.
It was interesting. It didn't. Well, it's funny that it's the second year in a row that they went with a face-versus-face world title match.
Yeah.
They did Bret Diesel. And the Bret Diesel one was, A, a better match.
Yeah.
And, B, worked a little better. It was. What was funny is in that one, Bret seemed to be trying more deliberately to go a little heelish in that mm-hmm. one against Diesel, and the crowd was still cheering for him.
Right.
You know, it may have a thing to do with talent, you know,
right.
The crowd recognizing talent, that you know, which, you know, nowadays, if Bret worked against Diesel, there would be that contingent of fans that would
sure.
obviously cheer Bret. But back then, you know, you didn't have the vocal minority.
Right.
To borrow from one of your favorite presidents. Yeah, this didn't work. There was a mixed crowd response. The Bret got more boos this time.
Both wrestled as tweeners or even heels, which was weird.
Well, by the end, it was pretty obvious that the crowd sort of wanted Undertaker to win.
Yeah.
So I have two problems with this match, Bret Hart versus The Undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
One, Bret, as the champion, was very marginalized during this run.
Yes.
He took a complete backseat to the Taker-Diesel feud. Was almost a pawn to get that secondary match over.
Yeah,
that we talked
exactly.
About. The second, this should be pretty obvious, this match is way too long to have a BS finish.
Yeah.
Well, it's way. I mean, this thing goes like 30 minutes. They do a bunch of like outside-the-ring stuff, and then like Diesel just interferes in itself.
Here's the thing, too. And this was in the era where, again, there was going to be a February pay-per-view, but we were not yet at the – or were we at the point of 12 pay-per-views a year at that point? I don't think so. I think there were still a few – in 96, were they already up to 12 pay-per-views? They were – okay.
Well, In Your House started May of 95.
Okay. And that filled in all the rest of them. Okay. Well, I think still – you still had a thing where on paper you had a Big Four or a Big Five, if you want to include King of the Ring in there. I think they ran the risk of a devaluation of the Rumble card because for the third year in a row, complete BS finish to the WWF title match. 94, enough said about the Undertaker-Yoko madness. 95, we talked about it with Diesel and Bret. The
did Diesel no favors.
Cop-out non-finish.
Yeah.
And then this one here, this is a thing where, again, Bret complains about it a lot in his book, and a lot of people like to roll their eyes at Bret's complaining, but I'll tell you what, he's exactly right, because the only way that this can be portrayed, look, you get tombstoned by The Undertaker, you're getting pinned. That's the way it has pretty much always gone. In the modern era of kick out of finishers, whatever, maybe not so much. In that era, Kyle Ross,
oh, yeah,
uber protected finishers, uber protected Undertaker. He was supposed to lose. He would have lost in kayfabe had it not been for Diesel coming out to make the save.
Yeah, that even marginalized even more. I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's funny you talk about the eye rolling with Brett and some of his complaining. And
sometimes he's right.
No, sometimes he's right. And this period, this third world title reign of his, I really do see things like having watched the show. By the way, this is the first time I'd ever, true story, watched this show start to finish. I think I'd only seen part of the Rumble before.
Okay.
I'd actually never watched this match. I was just not interested really enough to ever watch this show.
I don't blame you. I don't think I'd seen this match before either.
I mean, the whole show, I had never watched like Ahmed, you know, Jared or Razor Goldust. I never watched those matches.
Right.
So it was very striking to me. I was like, wow. Like, just watching this whole show unfold, the booking at large, I was like, wow, does Brett have a point? Because even afterwards, there was no focus on him.
Yeah.
It was just very obvious that Michaels was going over at WrestleMania and that Brett was just going to put him over. And, I mean, even when, you know, I guess, you know, Brett beat Diesel, and that was good
at
Survivor Series. And he has that great match with Bulldog
in
December where they brought back the blood.
Right.
But, yeah, the whole build-up to WrestleMania, he was kind of built as a weak champion. And
there had to be a better way of getting that semi-main event at WrestleMania without completely marginalizing Brett.
But you know what's funny is you sort of want to see, I think Meltzer said this, so I'm stealing it from him. I read the old newsletter before this because it was available. Shouldn't they have just done Brett Taker again? Like,
well,
it was weird how it went from, okay, Diesel screws Undertaker to Diesel gets a title shot then, and guess what happened then in February? Undertaker screws him. Whereas, at least if it was like Brett Taker, Brett could be like, that's crap, you know, like, I want to beat this guy, and he could have played off the whole, you know, oh, you know, I would have kicked out or something like that. Yep. I don't need this guy's help, and they could have done the cage.
Yep.
It just,
and on the post
I didn't
show,
like it.
Gorilla Monsoon putting over, oh, there's no way there's going to be interference with a cage, which even then, you know, you're sitting there going,
it was okay.
Really?
It was okay, the way they did that.
Yeah, but
the cage match gimmick had not still mattered back then, I think.
It
wasn't in 1987, but I mean.
Well, and I'll tell you this, too. An interesting footnote to the things we're talking about here as well. Kevin Nash has since claimed in shoot interviews,
oh boy,
final straw for the decision for him to go to WCW, even beyond the money, was when they're sitting there in Louisville in February at the pay-per-view working out the finish, and Brett complained that what we're saying, that it made him look incredibly weak having to be saved in that match by The Undertaker. And it's funny. Kevin Nash loves to quote The Undertaker when The Undertaker is backing him up. Like, he wasn't even part of our crew. So you know he was unbiased. And Undertaker was like, MF-er, it's not always about you. And that Kevin Nash thought Brett was being selfish and being concerned with how he was being portrayed. And Nash was like, I want out of here. I want to go to another place where I can be the selfish one. And
I don't put a lot of stock in Kevin Nash's comments. This is a guy who uses things that are kind of true, but manipulates them the wrong way.
Right.
I think, like, Brett should have, of course Brett's concerned. Like, if that's the reason why he left, because another guy was trying to protect the spot, screw you, Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
Okay, like, it's like the thing with Goldberg. He always brings up, oh, well, people were chanting Goldberg sucks.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but they weren't ever chanting Nash should beat him.
Kevin Nash, I just want to see if I can say this with a straight face. Kevin Nash claims he left the WWF because he was offended by somebody else's politicking.
I can't say that with a straight face. He lied because he got a better deal.
He left because he got a better deal.
But anyway, we should point out, it was unique. Another thing that made that match, the world title match, kind of weird, it was the first time Taker, like, had to sell. And I think that kind of caused the weird crowd reaction.
Right.
Because for the three previous years, Undertaker was in those horrible matches with, like, the Giant Gonzalez's and the Kamalas and the Yokozunas and the Maples and the Kama Mustafas of the world, King Kong Bundy.
Oh.
Dear God, what... The fact he stayed over through that is,
IRS, I think, at the Royal Rumble in 95, right?
Yeah.
How come they didn't reference that for WrestleMania this year? I wrestled your father at Royal Rumble 95.
Because that's not his character.
Okay, well, all right.
Stop.
All right.
So, So I think Brett has a point with this one.
I do, too.
Well, now,
I clearly do.
And we've sort of touched, I guess, on the impact of the February pay-per-view.
Yep.
With Michaels, so here's something I want you to keep in mind now.
Okay.
When we move forward these Rumbles.
Okay.
There's pros and cons of having a February pay-per-view.
Yeah.
The pro, it's another big show, and, you know, the company can make money, and that's good.
Right.
The con is, for me, that they sometimes, and we'll see this especially next year in 97, and granted, there were some wild circumstances beyond their control there, they can get too cutesy.
Yep.
Because the February pay-per-view, what it allows them to do, it gives them an out to swerve the fans in the Rumble, and they're like, oh, well, we can just set it all right in February,
right.
Which, by the way, I don't think makes good business sense.
Yeah,
set your damn main event. Set your damn main event
right.
And promote it.
Right.
Don't, you know, treat the February pay-per-view for what it is, just kind of a placeholder pay-per-view. Don't do these cutesy swerves.
Right.
And at least here with Michaels in February, it was funny. They did the thing, and it worked. He puts his WrestleMania title shot on the line against Owen Hart. They have a good match.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it worked well from Owen injuring him in November. So that was good. But with Brett, you know, again, I didn't think – it did him no favors having another pay-per-view, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the downward spiral for him leading into WrestleMania. Again, at a time when business was good, at a time when he was doing his part to carry good matches, I was thinking about this in a general sense, this era that we're starting to leave behind now, the down period of the company, of that – in terms of top guys in the history of the business, and again, people might roll their eyes when I say this because of a lot of the complaining Brett's done about it, but I mean, Brett might be the unluckiest top guy in the history of professional wrestling. In terms of circumstances, the top guys from the previous era didn't put him over. Roddy Piper did at WrestleMania 8, but outside of that, none of the previous top guys put him over. He was dealing with a lot of the backstage politicking of the clique a lot of the time during his run, and gets the concussion, gets his career ended early by Goldberg. Bret Hart was probably the unluckiest guy of all time on top a guy who was on top for a good period of time. And I think this couple of months probably encapsulated that as well as anything.
I found it, the buys.
Okay.
This page is horrible, by the way, to like highlight this black screen. So it was a very...
What are you on, Lords of Paste?
No. So I'm not going to dignify this webpage.
Okay.
It's just some like Angel Fire. It's pretty crappy. This show, it was a moderate uptick. It did 260,000 buys.
Okay.
Up from 225 in 95, up from 200 in 94. However, this show actually did slightly better on pay per view than 97.
Okay.
So it's owed to Michaels. I just think that. It's just not a very interesting time for WWF here. And so, yeah, you could see some things that were on the uptick, but it's still not good. There was still a lot of, you know, the good of, all right, you know, Brett, Diesel, Michaels, whatever good they bring to the table.
Okay.
Not enough to outweigh the bad.
You know what? And how's this for a tease for 97? You've given me something I want to ask you about when we start talking about the 97 Royal Rumble. I have a theory as to why 96 might have done better than 97. So we'll get to that when we're talking 97. You have that to look forward to, everybody. Leave you on a cliffhanger.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.